Hello, everyone, and welcome. Today, I'm joined by Eve Chang, who has worked on some of the biggest mobile games ever launched. Games like Temple Run, Temple Run 2, games like Bejeweled Blitz. And so what we are going to talk about today is, first, we're going to talk about Eve's approach to live ops, especially working on some of these games that have been very successful. Secondly, how do you make design and product decisions for live games? Third, the biggest lessons learned working on some of these games. And then finally, just Eve's take on the current environment and some of the big challenges and difficulties that we are currently facing right here in facing the end of 2023 and going into 2024. Today's episode is sponsored by Data.ai. To access estimates for rankings, downloads, revenue, usage, or engagement for millions of apps on the App Store and Google Play, sign up for Data.ai. But to kick it off, Eve, thank you for your time. Welcome to the podcast. And I thought we'd just kick it off with maybe a little bit more context in terms of your background, just so that the audience can understand some of the experience that you've had.
Sure. Thank you, Joseph. So my name is Eve, and I've been in the video game industry for about 15 years. I started out on PC, free to play, and when mobile games started picking up, I realized that was the future. So I jumped onto that, and I was fortunate enough to be working with some of the biggest titles in the mobile game industry, including, like Joseph mentioned, Bejeweled Blitz and Temple Run and Temple Run 2. And now I'm working on my own projects based on my experience and the expertise I learned over the years.
Great. And Eve, I thought we would start with basically, when it comes to live ops and having worked on some of these games like Temple Run and Bejeweled Blitz, could you kind of describe your overall approach? If you were to think about like a framework for how you believe mobile game studios should be thinking about and should kind of structure the way they do their live ops, could you kind of give us a high level perspective in terms of how you approached it?
Sure. I always felt like we always have to answer three questions. One is what is the market void? What is being offered on the market that players are not getting? That if there is a void, does my game, can my game offer that? That's the market void question I would ask. Then I would ask, what do players want? What do they want that doesn't exist or exists, but not in a capacity that can be to its fullest? And third, of course, comes back to game itself. What do we get? What is our objective for the players to experience? Is it live ops? Is it new content? What drives the players coming back to the gameplay again and again? So I try to answer those three questions by first looking at the market, looking at what's available, and looking at the players' communities and to see what are they voicing and what are they talking about, what are they excited about, and what are they asking for.
Right. And just to go a little bit deeper on that, and just from a practical perspective, so how does that kind of manifest in a team discussion or get operationalized? So what I mean by that is, so you ask these questions, the market void, what players want, things like that. And do you kind of first brainstorm a bunch of those things and come up with a bunch of initiatives? And then where do you get some of those ideas, or how do you determine, yes, we are filling a market void, or no, we are not filling a market void? If you can go into a little bit more detail.
Sure. I'll give you an example. For Bejeweled Blitz, it was a very old game that everybody loved, but it's obviously aging with time. So I looked at what was going on in the market, and I saw that most of the games that are match threes that developed after Bejeweled Blitz all had some sort of character to interface with the players, not understanding the demographic were mostly female, and mostly wanting to have some sort of connection to the game itself. I saw that that's what the market's driven, and that's where we were short on. The markets are providing plenty of that, but we ourselves as a game does not provide that. And so we discussed how can we bridge the void, and looking at our product to see which systems that could benefit from having some sort of character interactions to help the players to have a better experience.
I see. So it sounds like you kind of start with, in this particular case, you looked at market competitors, you then formed a hypothesis that, you know, similar to these other games that were building a personal connection with the player, that you believe that you could do something similar. And so then you, what, you designed that feature, you implemented, you rolled it out, and then how did you decide? So a couple of questions. One, how did you decide to do that first or second, or whatever the prioritization question? And then secondly, how did you try to validate either before you launched this feature and after you launched this feature, whether it was the correct thing to do or not?
Well, first of all, we looked at existing performance of existing metas in game, and we realized the ones that are more competitive are actually underperforming. So the hypothesis was formed that because the demographic, they probably are more solo journey players than competitor players. So therefore, we looked at a whole bunch of systems that could help people who are mostly solo journey players to have a better experience, and how we can utilize that system to help players experience more of the game of the different metas that they may not explore on their own. So we look at all the systems, and then my bar was go back, explain to your grandmother. If she can't understand how this works, it's not right for them. So we finally came up with a system that was easy to understand, that actually helped them navigate to different parts of the meta system of Bejeweled Blitz. And then we decided to implement that. And that took a long time to nail down, because it seems simple, but to things that look simple are usually very complex to make it look simple. But we streamlined it in a way that any player can come in, and they would not need to navigate through all different points of the game. They can just go to the quest system, and it will direct them to all the systems they want with a character assistant. Her name's Gemma, and she will help you do whatever quest that she's asking you to do.
Right. And one of the things that you mentioned is that you were thinking about this feature in the context of what you were calling single journey player or something like that?
Solo journey player.
And so I'm wondering, do you have the concept of basically player personas? And then are you considering these different features from the perspective of different player personas, or did that not factor into how you rolled this feature out?
It definitely had a factor into it. Obviously, with the limited data, with the privacy nowadays, we have little insights into player behaviors. Just based, we can just gauge from the player session length and what they're engaging most and what performs well to take a gander at what could their personas are. And so definitely takes a huge factor. And obviously that's a little bit of a gamble, because we have seen some metas that are not performing to target, but we don't know if the hypothesis that they are more solo journey players has been proven before. So this is something that has never been proven before. So we had to do a test to see how well the players respond to get more specific and focused to this particular personas. And it did perform really well. Day one, it outperformed the hypothesis by 20%. We were floored. We were like, what? And over time, after 3 months, it still outperformed the hypothesis by 10 to 12%. So that data collection, that data verification tells us our players indeed are enjoying the solo journey more, and they're spending more time, and they're interested in spending money once they're having the fun that they're looking for. And so overall, it had a really positive lift on revenue, on session length, on even a slowing of the decay of the MAU as well.
Okay. And so like the second topic that I had mentioned in the intro that we would talk about is how to make design and product decisions for live games. And so just kind of going back even to this example of this personalized avatar type of feature, when it comes to like, let's say there are multiple ideas and your team says, oh, we should do a Gemma, or someone else says, no, the big problem is like balancing the levels, and somebody else comes up with another idea. And so when you have these different ideas of how to improve the game, and these different, to your point, you had an ideation process, then you had specific hypotheses, right? That, you know, we need to create a more personalized experience by having a relatable avatar to blah, 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 versus these other ideas. How did you think through whether that was which scenario or which thing you guys should work on, and whether that was right or wrong? Did you just try it? Did you try to validate it before you put it into product, or did you validate it? You know what? We're just going to try it, see what happens. And then if it doesn't work, we'll roll it back. What was that approach?
The approach was to look at existing features and try to do a forecast of all different feature ideas, what the possible impact are for the KPIs. Yep. And obviously, these are best guesses. And at the end of the day, the product owner has to make a call on which one that makes most sense. And in this case, because we saw the Meta that will come more competitive, weren't performing as well. And this one, even though it was never done before, my hypothesis was that it would help players navigate through more systems and therefore would extend their session length time. And we did forecast based on that. So,
So there's kind of two things at play that I want to kind of disaggregate for the audience. So the first thing that you mentioned is you were looking at impact. So something like, I assume you guys use like an ICE-RICE or Zynga-style expected outcomes model to say, okay, if we design this feature, here's the potential impact it could have. Then you kind of stack rank stuff and decided what. So that prioritization seems like it was pretty standard for in terms of the approach that you guys took.
Yes.
Then what about like for this Gemma feature in particular? Let's say you think, you're like, yes, this is a feature that will have this impact on retention or monetization or whatever. But let's say there are other people on the team that are like, no, it's going to have a negative impact. It's not going to be good. And how did you resolve the differences? Because ultimately, game development is art, science, data, blah, 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 combined. So how did you guys resolve towards a perspective on what that impact is, potential impact is? And if there were differences in opinion, like, you know, you've got two people on your team who said, hey, this Gemma feature is amazing. And two people were like, oh my God, it's the worst feature ever. How did you guys resolve?
We had that. But the great thing about Visual Blitz, because it was so, so well known, so popular, had a huge fan base. And we had a super fan club where we actually have selective about 80 to 100 people who signed NDA who can preview features that we might be working on so we can get some qualitative data. And so when my team is up in arms saying this will never work and we don't believe in it, I detest this idea, we said, well, let's take it to that qualitative fan base that we have and see what they think. And the result was complete landslide would be like 8-2, like the percentage wise with people voting. And so obviously that's still risk because it's qualitative, but I help persuade the team because they see that the players are aligned with the process that we were working on. So it was worth trying. Obviously, if it did not perform, we will either look at the data to tweak it or like you said, go back. But that,
got it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so even before you launched it, there was like a practice of getting player feedback, product validation through speaking to an existing player base. And those players that are playing your game a lot, that's your hardcore audience. So they should know, or they should have a perspective on whether something is good or bad. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so it's not done in a vacuum for sure, but there is some guesswork, as you know, with game designs.
Yeah, it's not, that's the thing with our craft, right? It's like, It's not a perfect science for sure. Okay. And so then maybe now rolling into the third topic that we talked about, Eve, you've had really great experience. And so whether at EA or Imagi or other places, when it comes to maybe some of the biggest lessons learned in terms of live ops and some of the mistakes, I think it'd be awesome for our audience to hear about some of your experience, some of the mistakes you've made so that we could potentially, you know, get to understand what those mistakes are so we could avoid them in the future.
My biggest lesson learned is to listen to the players and not just qualitatively, that's important, but knowing who your players are is so important. For example, for Temple Run 2, during COVID, we completely pivoted the content to the psychology of the players out there. They are feeling anxious, they're feeling isolated, and Temple Run itself was a player running away from Demon Monkey in a desolated area. And to us, how do we cater the game towards the player to have a better experience while releasing some of that anxiety? So we made a very serene, beautiful map called Enchanted Palace that looks like Taj Mahal and something grand in Asia somewhere that's mystic. And then we had one's a healer, one's an herbologist as the characters. So we helped bridge that sense of anxiety with the game mechanics, that they were actually collecting herbs, they were actually helping people. And so that was very successful. People really respond well to it. They even said that this is the map. They will come back to play just to look at the environment. And so that gave them something, a peace of mind that usually Temple Run traditionally did not have. So right. I think some learnings from mistakes that I would say is that whenever we look at data and try and make decisions solely on data, that usually bites us unexpectedly. For example, we realized that people were turning off in the Fatui early on between 5,000, under 5,000 meters. So the solution, obviously, to us is to make it easier so that people don't die as often so that they can get past the 5,000 meters. Turns out the churn rate was still the same, and even though it was easier, and that actually impacted revenue because they were watching less ads to do Save Me. So it was like, okay, let's go back. Why did it not work? It's easier. Why did they still churn out? Well, it was easier, but it was more boring. So what we ended up doing was very, very funny. It was our change. We just put signs to tell people ahead of time, there's going to be a churn. All we did is put signs up, and all of a sudden people had a better experience because they feel like they're in charge. They can prepare for the turns. And so the improvement was a lot more obvious, and the churn rate was improved for about, I think, had to lift about 7%. So that tells us not to only look at data-driven stuff, but also look to players, what their experiences are, and try to make decisions based on their experiences versus a data-driven decision. For me, that's a takeaway.
Yeah, I think that's a really strong lesson to convey. And I can also just tell you from my experience, I have seen so many tests that have been poorly implemented, right? And it's like, oh yeah, this survey told us this, but then the survey was off the back of one of these like incentivized, get 30 gems to fill out the survey where people would just go tap, 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 close, give me my 30 gems, right? And so you got the whole notion of garbage in, garbage out. And so I think there's definitely an art to like how you implement specific tests. And then also to your point, and I think the Temple Run case that you mentioned is one of how do you interpret the problem statement, right? Correct. So then ideating and coming up with, okay, here are the various potential reasons. And, you know, one of the things we do is we build a logic tree to try to break down what the potential things are, but then being more thoughtful on that, it could be because of the challenge, but maybe there are other reasons at play that could be impacting the loss in retention or the 5,000 meters, as you had mentioned.
Yeah. That sign thing works so well, we implement in every map throughout.
Okay.
If that's awesome. How successful that was, but that was completely not, there was no data that would show that would be effective. So I think you just have to see it from players' perspective to try a few things and try to see if what works and be willing to change and pivot and ask the right question. If the question wasn't answered correctly, maybe we didn't ask the right question.
Right. Any other lessons that you'd like to convey to the audience, Eve? I mean, you got some good ones, by the way. So, I mean, no worries if you don't have any.
I think one thing I do say that because we are very driven in the mobile industries to get people to play longer, I think it is always comes back to give players what they want. For example, for Temple Run, we did Earth Day content. That was met with a lot of obstacle from the team because they thought dirtying up a map, people would be upset about it. And instead of picking up coins, we're picking up trash. Turns out players love that. They resonate with the fact that they care about the earth. They want to help clean up their environment, and they care about social cause. It actually united them in a way that we did not foresee. And the best part was that revenue showed that it worked, but the Dapple Rap actually came back, told us it was Tim Cook's favorite Temple Run 2 content.
Wow, great.
So I think those are the things that I think we keep on listening to play, looking to what they want. I think that's the biggest lesson I have, because we can make a game we like, but ultimately the game is for the players, and not just we should like it, but the players should love it.
Yeah, and I think the point that you're talking about is a really complicated issue, in my opinion, right? Because I can't tell you the number of times in my career where there are the people, like there are people who are what I would call like the Steve Jobs or Elon Musk. They know what the audience wants. Like Steve Jobs, when you know, he's like, yes, players want, or like like our audience wants something like the iPhone or the iPod or the this or the that. But, and there's so many people who think they are Steve Jobs for game design, right? Mm-hmm. And they lack the humility of saying, well, actually, it's not what I think, it's what the players really think. And so to your point, I really hope that people are a little bit more humble in terms of that aspect. Okay, so Eve, any final lessons learned or should we move on to the market?
Well, I think one thing that I noticed more and more, because gaming is such a big lucrative market and everybody's trying to get mm-hmm. a piece of a pie, more and more I'm seeing people talk about the product like a product, and which it is a product, but it ultimately it's a game. I think right. we have to remember the fun. No matter how much money you want to make, if the fun isn't there, doesn't matter what the forecast is, doesn't matter what the data says, if the players are being treated like a wallet, it's not. It's a very hard battle to win. But if they're having fun, they are. It's entertainment for them. They will happily spend money when they're enjoying the experience. And I think to me, the user perspective is so important that I always say I'm a player first kind of producer, because mm-hmm. unless we provide the fun or provide the experience for the players that they enjoy, they're not coming back. And that's what Live Ops is all about. It's about bringing them back again and right. again and again.
Yeah, I think what you're saying really reminds me of this concept I first heard from Scopely. But the concept of two ends of the spectrum in terms of monetization. On the player side, it's like the willingness to pay, which is that, to your point, players enjoy the game so much, they're looking for reasons to pay in the game. Very similar to Riot games, right? And the games that you have so much fun, it's like, oh yeah, this cosmetic, whatever, I want to pay. And on the other side, the back end is the payment optimization. Like, how can you drive sales? How can you drive monetization techniques to just maximize the amount that players pay. And sounds like from your perspective, you really are more around the philosophy of fun and willingness to pay and to drive that aspect of monetization rather than just really trying to squeeze as much money from players as possible.
Yes, but I also mm-hmm. believe good design should have monetization already naturally built
for
in
sure.
so that yep. they naturally want to spend money. So we don't have to squeeze, because when they get here, right. they naturally are looking for
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
That's the best of the marriages for me.
Yeah. So it should be a light squeeze. It should be like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I gotcha.
You know, it is that if you are willing to spend $5, but they give you a deal so good, you end up spending $15 and you have a good time,
right.
you're going to come
right.
back and do it again. But if you squeeze them so hard that you get the $5 out of them, then they may never spend another dime again. That's mm-hmm. a bad experience.
Right. And I think this last point also then connects and ties back to this final topic that I wanted to cover with you, which is really around the market and the current market environment. And just so you know, I've been speaking to a lot of people in the industry, and I would say, in particular, I would say even like the Chinese leaders and people who I have been speaking to are so negative on the mobile gaming market for the next few years. Mm-hmm. Like they literally go into hibernation. They've seen a dramatic impact to performance of live games that they have launched from China. And so I wanted to get your take on the current market environment. And also maybe one leading question is, and when we talk about this last lesson that you learned, I also believe that in the current market, it's kind of shifting towards you should be more focused on willingness to pay rather than payment optimization, just because of where the economy is. You know, we've got record credit card debt. Like people, in my opinion, need to feel better about what they're spending money on.
Sure.
And so handing it over to you, Eve, in terms of your current take on the current market difficulties and things like that. And maybe you could kind of describe not only how you would characterize the current market difficulties, but then what do you think developers need to do to thrive and survive this kind of new market environment that we're heading into?
I think there are multiple reasons. Economy is definitely a big part of it, but the players are smart. They can see when we're mm-hmm. trying to squeeze a dime out of them. And when we do it well, they tolerate it. When we don't do it well, they don't tolerate it. And more so, like I just mentioned previously, I think a lot of people are very data-driven, very product monetization, optimization-driven, that it leaves the players not a desirable experience. So I truly believe to understand what players want out of a game, and if you give them what they want, then that will help us sustain through the difficult times. Because as we know, you know, coffee is great for doing depression and doing heights. It's because people want coffee, whether they're having a hard time economically, whether they're making money, coffee and tea always do well throughout the times. Games can be like that. I think just we have to give them what the players want and give them a sense, whatever the sense of satisfaction, the sense of achievement, the relaxation, or the sense of being social with their friends, whatever it is that your game provides, if you can give them that ultimate experience, I think that's the key to survive and to thrive in this market current state.
Okay. Well, Eve, that's all the questions that I have. It was kind of like a quick discussion here, but I feel like a lot of the lessons that you have mentioned and some of the learnings that you've shared are super valuable, and hopefully the audience can learn from that. Do you have any last minute message for the audience or ways in which they can contact you?
Sure. I am actually currently very busy trying to put up my website. It's Neuro Sisters Studios, and it's about neurology. It's about psychology of the players, and it's obviously about females in the game space, but it's not exclusive to the female audience. It's just more female focused. So neurosistersstudios.com.
Okay, and I will put a link to your website in the show notes.
Sure.
But Eve, thank you for your time and sharing your lessons. I think it's very valuable. And for our audience, we will catch you next time.
Thank you so much, Joseph. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.